come up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today we have as our guest poet Martha Serpas, who just came out with a new book called Diener, and it is a collection of poems. And I'm sure right now maybe only 2% of you don't know what Diener is, but for those 2% who don't know what it is, I'll explain it. It is the person in a morgue who takes care of the dead bodies. Martha Serpas, of course, is a very well-known poet. She teaches at the University of Houston. And we're going to talk a little bit about the Diener, both the profession and the book. And on Poetic License today, Diana Sevilla is in the studio, and she brought her cajon, which is, well, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a box, and it produces sounds. It's like a drum, like an ancient drum. And she's going to recite a poem by Lorca. So stick around. You're not going to want to miss that. Reading this book, in fact, reading many books, causes me to think about an experience I once had as a professor here at the University of Texas, El Paso. I was teaching a fiction writing seminar. I had a student who only wanted to write vampire stories, which in the language of academia is genre fiction, which we discourage our students from participating in. We don't want them to write genre fiction for various reasons. I won't get into the snobbery aspect of it, which I'm sure some of you think, well, why can't you write genre fiction? What's wrong with bestsellers with vampires and werewolves and all those other cliches? There's nothing wrong with it. But because when a new writer begins to enter a genre, the first mistakes they make are creating cliches, creating structures that are pre-existing. And they do this in any kind of art form that they first begin to enter when they don't have the craft and they don't have the experience. And I can tell when somebody is doing a very superficial emulation of Raymond Carver, who's one of the greatest American short story writers, because that's what I study. I study literature. I study character-based and language-based fiction. But I can't tell when somebody is being cliche with a vampire novel or a science fiction novel. And so just on that level alone, I discourage genre writing. And of course, also for all the snobby reasons that I won't mention today. So I told him, I says, no, you know, you got to quit writing these vampire stories, man. I never read Amy Myers. She's the one, I believe, that wrote that vampire trilogy that all the kids used to go watch with the vampire and the werewolf and that love triangle. Stephanie Myers. It was Stephanie Myers. I never read her, but I did pick up the book one time in Barnes & Noble and read the first paragraph, and it was, excuse my snobbery, incredibly flat. The prose was incredibly, incredibly flat. And we care about language, us literary snobs. So I told him, no more vampire stories. He says, why? And I says, because, you know, and I tried to explain it to him. He goes, I do not want to write literary fiction because all you guys care about is death. And there was a collective gasp in the room. You know, all the writers who care about fiction gasp. And I thought, what? And I said to him, I said, what are you talking about? And he says, yeah, that's all literary people care about is death. And I thought it was the stupidest thing I'd ever heard in my life. But then later on, I was in Buenos Aires. And I took a year off, and I used to walk the streets all the time. And I spent a whole year just working on my novel. I would write, and I would write, and then I would walk the streets. And for lack of a better word, I got the sense of, I wouldn't say death, but I got the sense that in the city there are energies that may not have bodies, that there's certain energies in cities. There's this belief among many systems, including, I could argue, physics, when we look at the first law of thermodynamics, that when somebody dies, their energy sticks around for a while. And I say the first law of thermodynamics because that's the idea that the law of conservation of energy, that energy cannot be destroyed, it can only be transferred. And when a body dies, that is heat, that is energy, it's probably not going to disappear. It just can't. It's going to perhaps manifest itself in other ways. And if you just are recently dead, that consciousness, which is not a part of the brain that you can point at, which is not part of the physiology that you can point at, may still exist. And that energy may cling to like energies. But anyway, I was walking the streets of Buenos Aires, and I came to this crossroads, a literal crossroads, and there were some gypsies that had come from some town out from the outskirts, very poor women, and they were dancing. And they had this old man that looked like a gypsy stereotype, missing tooth and a little round hat, and he was playing an accordion, and they were all dancing, and I was mesmerized, and I just sat there and just stared. And as I stared at them, I just got this sense that across from me, staring at them, was Lorca, García Lorca, which is kind of strange. He did kind of spend a lot of time in Buenos Aires, but I got this sense that Lorca was staring at these two. And then just a couple of weeks later, I was looking up Lorca poems, and I found this poem about gypsies at the crossroads. And I thought, well, it's possible, since image, and that's what we care about in literary fiction, that's what we care about in poetry. We care about the image, among other things, but we care about the image. Image is archetype. Image is archetype, and archetype is a energetic image that exists outside of time and outside of meaning. It's not the same as metaphor. And certainly these ladies, these gypsies dancing at the crossroads, were an archetype. And so it's possible that as I was looking at them, since archetype does not exist in time and space, but exists in the collective consciousness, that as I was looking at these ladies dancing, Lorca was indeed looking at these ladies dancing. And maybe even other artists and poets were looking at the exact same time. And if that's true, then I was accessing part of the dead. I was accessing the world of the dead. And then it caused me to study Lorca even more, and I encountered his idea of duende. And duende, he says, is this dark spiritual energy in a work of art. He says not everybody has it, but one of the things he says is that it comes from below. It's not an angel. It's more, he didn't say it's a demon, but it's a spirit. And he says, where death is possible, there the duende will show up. So I'm thinking, well, maybe this kid wasn't that inaccurate after all. Maybe there is a connection between how we access archetype, how we access rhythms, incantations in our language that create and invite the spirit of the dead into our work. Or maybe not. Stick around. We're going to talk to Martha Serpas, author of The Diener, a great collection of poems. Martha Serpas is the author of three collections of poetry, including The Dirty Side of the Storm and Cote Blanche. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Nation, The Southwest Review, and all the other literary journals that have rejected me in my career as a writer. She is a chaplain with a degree from the Yale Divinity School and teaches in the MFA program in creative writing at the University of Houston. Her latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is The Diener. Martha Serpas, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you.
I just finished your book, The Diener, and I just think it's a fantastic book. Before we get started on getting into some of the poems, tell us what diener means. I had to look it up, and I'm glad I did, because it's a really fascinating word.
And you were well served if you found it. A lot of dictionaries don't contain it. I had never heard it until I started doing some chaplaincy in a hospital. And it's the person who runs the morgue, not necessarily the pathologist, in most cases not, but the person who actually takes care of the bodies in the morgue. And it comes from the German for service. I did some chaplaincy work and continue to do so when I can at Tampa General, and I met the wonderful diener there. And, of course, the term is used, you know, all over the hospital without note, but I thought it was fascinating. And the particular diener there, his name is Rafael, believe it or not.
Palio, Rafael Palino, right?
Yes, the patron of healing, yes. He was very kind to me, and when I had breaks and time, he would let me come down to the morgue, and he would teach me. He actually did a fair amount of organ harvesting because he was a medical doctor in the Dominican Republic. But when he came to the U.S., of course, he wasn't allowed to practice a pathology position. So he actually did more than most deaners do, and I was just fascinated by his work.
When I was reading the first poem, The Diener, I couldn't help but think of when I was in Buenos Aires. I used to go visit this cemetery in Chacarita, And it was just this amazingly huge city of mausoleums with these high-rise buildings with multiple levels, and you can just go up and down. And there were these men who had a little booth, a little chair, or a stool, and then, you know, maybe a little table, and they would clean the graves, and they would freshen the, you know, make sure the flowers, the plastic flowers looked fresh, but they worked entirely on tips. And I thought, man, what a patient job. And when I think about the job as the deaner, I'm thinking that even though it's an incredibly humble position, there's something deeply meaningful and spiritual about it.
Absolutely. When I think of Raphael, he really considers his work a calling to care for the dead. He often has salsa playing in the background while he's,
nice.
He has this deep reverence and care for what he's doing. That's very moving.
I would say that this book is not all about the deaner. I mean, it's not all about the dead. It's also about being a chaplain in a hospital, and some of the most moving poems, like Pearl Snap, for example, have to do with that position as a chaplain that, you know, must be very difficult at times to have to deal with families in their great time of loss. But it also has to do with the erosion of the wetlands in Louisiana. And I'm wondering what the connection is between your commitment to the wetlands and your commitment to being a chaplain in a hospital.
For me, the very basic and difficult idea of things dying in order for other things to come into being is central to both of those experiences. For me, it's very hard for me to look at the wetlands and know that they're already gone. It cannot be reversed. And at the same time, want to work to preserving them in this paradoxical way. And in the hospital, there are moments when someone or something is being lost, and we know that's necessary, and it's also very difficult. And so that interstitial space is where I saw those poems dealing with the same subject matter and emotion.
When you wrote the book, did you know it was going to have particular themes, or were you just writing poetry, and then you put the book together and saw the themes and organized it according to that?
The latter. And that's been my experience. At the end of my first book, I didn't see at all that the poems were leading toward this meditation on land loss. And then The Dirty Side of the Storm, which is my second book, is, you know, clearly about that. But it's sort of like I didn't see it coming. Mm-hmm. And I did chaplaincy work for about 5 years before I wrote a single poem that had anything to do with it. And so I didn't see how the two were going to intertwine until I was really putting the deaner together.
I interview a lot of poets, and that's how most of them do. I think sometimes when you try to be theme forward at the beginning of the book, it may, number one, take a heck of a long time to do, or take very little time to do and not be very good.
I find it very difficult to have any sort of framework in mind and write toward that.
You teach in an MFA program at the University of Houston, which is known as one of the, quite frankly, best MFA programs in the country. Your poems seem to have incredible, well, first of all, the language is amazing, and the images, you know, I mean, you can really enter into these poems and linger there and be in the moment. But also the poems, you know, whether you're conscious of it during the writing time or not, because I think a lot of times when we write, we're in some sort of zone, prayer-like zone, where we're not really thinking of what our meaning is. But the poems themselves speak of these are poems with a purpose. And I'm wondering, as a professor in the MFA program, where you, I assume, teach poetry, do you find that programs oftentimes emphasize craft and production over purpose? Why we write poetry is perhaps, you know, not as important as, you know, the focusing on craft?
Yes, I think that's true. Perhaps the way I'd say it is that purpose is sort of assumed to be understood, right? Mm-hmm. These writers get together to work on their craft, we say, not so much on their practice. It's assumed that there's a passion, a commitment, a vision that's already there. We're working on craft. And I do think that sometimes that's overweighted. At Houston, I teach a class that's now called Ecopoetics on the Gulf. It used to go by a nickname, the Shrimp Boat Project, and it's a long story, but it had to do with two artists who started this project of actually working on a shrimp boat, learning to trawl, and letting that really be their artwork. And so part of this class that I teach is about reading shore lyrics, the very American, I stand on the shore and contemplate the universe, you know, the Whitman, the Crane, the Bishop, and reading Gulf Coast poets, and also spending a lot of time down in the marshes in Galveston, say about 25% of our class time, so that those students come to Houston, come to the Gulf area, and actually get a sense of where they are, not just a few city blocks where they live and the campus of UH. And that groundedness, I think, helps students rethink what it is they want to do with their poetry, if that makes sense.
Right. No, no, absolutely. It sounds like a great class. Do you ever teach just a straight-up workshop?
Oh, yes. And I also teach a class that's in which the students read what I would call wisdom literature, or to steal a title from Wallace Stevens, you probably wouldn't like this use of it, How to Live, What to Write. And so we read pieces of everything from the Tao in Genesis to Emerson to Simone Weil. And it's really a class about encountering the text and what it means for their writing lives rather than sort of dissecting the text for craft.
I'm talking to Martha Serpas, whose new book, The Diener, is, well, it's brand new. I got an advance uncorrected proof. And it's a fantastic book. Some of the poems have appeared in The New Yorker. You're a regular contributor to The New Yorker, which is like the hardest magazine ever to get into if you're a poet. The Birmingham Review, so many different places. It's a fantastic book. But I can't help, when I'm reading it, to think about you got a master's degree from the Yale School of Divinity, and the poems are quite frankly deeply spiritual, and I can't help but think of the link between spirituality and writing poetry. And just on the level of when you go to divinity school, I imagine it's incredibly challenging scholar-wise, that you have to do a lot of exegesis, you have to do a lot of reading, you have to do a lot of writing. And I think just that experience with exegesis itself is incredibly linked to poetry. In fact, I think if you look at if you did a survey of some of the best poets writing today, probably 80% of them have incredibly strong spiritual backgrounds. Either their fathers or mothers were pastors or something like that. Do you find that your experience as a chaplain, your experience with exegesis, causes you to think about the text in a different way?
Well, earlier you used the term prayer-like with respect to writing. And that's certainly my experience of it. The only time that I feel completely grounded and giving full attention to something is when I'm writing. And that's an understanding of prayer, I think.
Right.
With respect to text, reading scripture or reading theological text is a very different experience than reading text to dissect craft and technique. Although that is a little unfair, because of course poems that we are studying can change our lives in the same way that we can read scripture and theological text and learn a lot about rhetoric and technique and craft as well. But I think you're right that the reverence and close attention that's paid to studying religious texts is influential on how one approaches poetry later.
I love the book, and I'm hoping that you might be able to read one of the poems for us.
Sure, I'd love to. Which one would you like me to read?
Well, I like so many of them. I like The Diener. I like a lot of them. But you know what I think would be really great for the radio would be Pearl Snap. And I had to look up what pearl snap meant. It's those pearl buttons that you click together on, like, Western-style T-shirts, like cowboy
That's
T-shirts.
Right. Yes. Pearl snap. Education is the answer to our social woes. And not the get-a-good-job after high school, but the deep-plotting kind, the making-of-many-books kind, get everybody together to debate the big questions kind. When I'm in Walmart and some kid dangling by the wrist is screaming, his mom in shorts that slice her thigh, saying something deep to him through her teeth, her long hair smelling like she has more than one job, I know it's not her fault. She's carrying a combination wallet, cigarette case with a pocket for the lighter. Her husband, well, the father of her last two, her divorce isn't final from her ex, is waiting in the truck, a Ford. Her dad had a problem with that, and so they went duck hunting and worked it all out. Her man didn't graduate, even though his junior high let the boys go when trawling season began, but going back got harder. She took typing and bookkeeping and even AP math. She says she manages a convenience store where you learn how to just take on the present. Right now, she just needs to find that pearl snap for her oldest. And why is it suddenly so dang hard to find a boy's 12 pearl snap? There are a few like her in every cow town. When the copter brings a woman's child, a certain woman of that kind, from the parish or the county to the city, and we all stand around the trauma bay watching environmental services sweep up the gauze wrap and cut clothes, and that woman from the boonies is still not here, driving her husband's truck as hard and steady as she can, I'll meet her in family consult or stand her in the shiny hallway. She'll go anywhere. And depending on what the test tube intern has to say, she'll either squat, lay her forearm against her stomach, and loose that first whale groan that defies conceit, or she'll tutor me in the language of living in good faith, of staring down what I have to say and opening her mind to it, taking it in like a nursling and knowing it whole until the two can sleep side by side. We tell her, it's going to be a long road, and she says, as long as there's a road, I'm on it.
That was Martha Serpas reading the poem Pearl Snap from her new book, The Deaner. Martha, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire. I wish you the best of luck with this book.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
We are very fortunate to have Diana Sevilla in the studio again. We had her before, and she did a poem by Cesar Vallejo. She sang it, and today she's going to do a couple of poems, kind of a mixture by Garcia Lorca. Explain what you're going to do.
Well, I put a melody inspired by Marta Gomez's own version of Canción del Naranjo Seco, a rendition that she did to a song that she
The Song of the Dried Orange Tree.
Yes. Inspired by that, I decided, when you referred me to Despedida by Lorca, I was like, I think I'd like to do both of these together. So that's basically how it came about.
And you're sitting on an instrument from Peru that you call the cajon. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
I don't call it the cajon.
It is called the cajon.
I don't call it. I call it something else. Her name is Semalu. I baptized her Semalu.
Oh, nice.
Hummingbird.
Cool.
I got inspired by Luisa Berturrea's book that I'm reading, The Hummingbird's Daughter.
Awesome.
Anyway, yeah. So
okay.
this is her name. But so the cajon, it's an Afro-Peruvian. It's an instrument from Peru, from the Afro-Peruvian music, which I am having a very intense love affair. Have had it for the last 10 years.
And I wish you could see in the studio right now. We're sitting around the table, and the lights are off, and a candle is burning, and I'm going to turn it over to Diana Sevilla.
Si muero, dejad el balcón abierto. El niño come naranjas desde mi balcón, lo veo. Ay, si muero, dejad el balcón abierto. El niño come naranjas desde mi balcón, lo veo. El segador ciega el trigo y desde mi balcón lo siento. Ay, si muero, dejad el balcón abierto. Yara, 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 Córtame la sombra, leñador, líbrame del suplicio de verme sin toronjas, leñador, porque nací entre espejos. Córtame la sombra, leñador, líbrame del suplicio de verme sin toronjas, leñador, porque nací entre espejos. El día me da vueltas y la noche me copia en todas sus estrellas. Quiero vivir sin verme, leñador. Quiero vivir. Yara, 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 yara. Y hormigas y vilanos soñaré que son mis hojas y mis pájaros. Quiero vivir sin verme, leñador. Quiero vivir.
Wow. That was Diana Sevilla doing two poems by García Lorca. Thank you. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
If I die, leave the balcony open. Absolutely. I want to feel that air on my face.
I want to be around somehow.
Stick around. I'd like to thank my guest, Martha Serpas, for joining me on Words on a Wire, and Diana Sevilla for that wonderful rendition of García Lorca's poems. And Diana just told me that she picked up a copy of Diner, and now she loves it. It's a great book, and it's been a great show. I'm Daniel Chacon. Don't forget, the next book you read may not necessarily save you from death, but while you're living, it's going to be awesome.
I'm up on a tight